Checking on the Arts is made possible by the Memphis Symphony Orchestra, starting tomorrow and running through Sunday in actually several locations in Midtown, is the Indy Memphis Film Festival. This thing just gets bigger every year. Eric Jambor is here with me, who is, I don't know what you are. Are you the festival director? Or are you the...
Yeah, I am indeed.
Okay. And Morgan John Fox, who is one of our local filmmakers, whose movie has been getting a lot of buzz here lately. And welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Eric, why don't you sort of start and give us the overview here. Is it just my imagination, or does this thing really get bigger every year?
It actually does, yeah. And, you know, we're thrilled this year because we have the folks over at Duncan Williams Investment Bankers on as our presenting sponsor, which is letting us do a lot of great new things. And the main thing we're excited about is we're basically turning our tickets and passes upside down. So instead of having to buy a ticket for every movie, you can buy a low-price weekend pass and basically enjoy most of the program. Just you wander around and explore and discover stuff and maybe find your next favorite film. And that's a big thing we're pushing. So you don't have to worry about these films you've not heard about but kind of sound interesting. You can just go try them and really, you know, float your curiosity and enjoy things.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. I want to encourage everyone to go to the website, IndyMemphis.com, and you can see all the listings and what's on when and what the buzz is about various of these movies. As we mentioned, Morgan John Fox is here. His movie is called This Is What Love in Action Looks Like, and it's been getting a lot of interest, a lot of press. Morgan, welcome. It's good to have you on the show, finally.
I'm so glad to finally be on. This is my first time, so I'm very excited.
This is a film that has been getting a lot of press, a lot of talk here. And what's this about?
It's about an event that happened back in Memphis in 2005. It's a documentary about a teenager who was forced into a reparative therapy program based in Raleigh called Love in Action. He basically told them that he was gay, and they wanted to change his sexuality by sending him to this program. And it turned into this huge international news story once all of his friends, high school age friends,
he started writing about it on his blog.
That's right. He did. So it became this huge story about, these teenagers standing up for one of their friends. And, it became a sort of an internet story because it was, a sort of viral story that spread all across the world, really. And, ended up in the New York Times and CNN and Good Morning America and that kind of thing. And so the documentary kind of fell in my lap because I was there the first day. So,
yeah, you actually were involved in the protests outside Love in Action.
That's right. Yeah, I'd worked with a lot of his friends on film projects and theater projects, so I knew them. And he went to the same high school that I went to, White Station, here in Memphis. And so I was there day one kind of helping handle media and that kind of thing and just brought my camera because I'm a filmmaker. And so I had no idea it was going to turn into something so big.
There's a fascinating story that goes along with this that when you first met with the director of Love in Action, John Smith, the director at that time, obviously there was some initial tension there, but you actually developed quite a close friendship with him.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of the situation is that, I kind of wanted to meet with him just to being on separate sides of a story. Sometimes it's something we don't get to do is talk to someone with such differing views from our own. And so I wanted to have that opportunity. And then surprisingly, over time, we kind of developed a friendship, even though we had strong differences. And then what happened is over time, he began to change his views. And he kind of attributed that friendship to being a big part of that. And so he will be at the Q&A, John Smith, along with former participants of Love in Action as well. They'll be there to participate. And it'll be one of the first times that any of those people have been in the same room together since their time at Love in Action. So should be interesting.
Yeah, John, I think he actually resigned from Love in Action. And that program is still active, but I understand the residential part of it is not anymore.
That's correct. The teenage program and the residential program that were intact when the protests began have dismantled.
The movie is This Is What Love in Action Looks Like, and it is airing on Friday evening at 7 p.m. at Playhouse on the Square, and then the Q&A is after that?
That's correct.
Okay. That sounds fascinating. Morgan, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about this. Eric, what are some other things that are going to be going on?
Well, part of what's fun about the festival is there's literally something in there for everybody, and the way we set it up with screenings at the Brooks and the Studio on the Square and the Playhouse on the Square, there are always different kinds of films running. So whether you like documentary films or films made by local filmmakers or narratives or shorts or even kids program, we have a great kids film called Eleanor's Secret that's running Saturday morning I think it's 10:30 over at the studio on the square, and it's this amazing French film about learning to read and fairy tales. Of course, you know, dubbed in English, so kids don't have to worry about reading, but it's a great, great film. And that's one I'm really looking forward to. But that's a big one. We've, of course, got the Paradise Lost trilogy that we're running, so you can follow that entire case from the very first film through the second one on Saturday, and then the closing film where we're bringing in Bruce Sanofsky, one of the directors, who will be presenting that and then giving him an award that night. So it's really a lot of fun. We hope people really take the time to explore the program online or pick up a program, you know, read about all the news coverage and see what films sort of inspire you. And what I like to say is festival's not about just sitting in a dark theater and watching movies. It's about the community experience. Yeah. So you can hang out in the cafe and you can meet the filmmakers, and we use the Playhouse as sort of the center of activity, and we make sure that there are ways to meet people, and there are free panels, and there's free music. And even when you go down to the studio on the square while you're waiting for a film, we're going to have some little live music things happening down there. So it's going to keep a lot of interesting life happening, I think, make things very nice for people.
Well, it's, as usual, it's a big event here in the Mid-South. I know it's something that that people look forward to every fall, so it's going to be a lot of fun. We're actually going to talk to some more of the filmmakers over the next couple of days here on Checking on the Arts and tell you about some more of these movies. But
yeah. And one thing actually to mention, since you're done with your membership drive, we have an anonymous membership challenge for Indie Memphis. And actually, if you become an Indie Memphis member, you get a free weekend pass. And so it's $50 for a membership, and that gets matched. Plus, you get this free weekend pass. So it's a great way to enjoy things. And I do want to mention, if you want to see Morgan's film, it's selling out quickly, and it's one of our gala screenings that the weekend passes don't count for. So it's a good time to, you know, make sure you
get online and reserve a ticket.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Once again, IndieMemphis.com. Go there. You can see descriptions of all these movies as well as their show times. And it's really, go to the website, because there's far more than we can possibly talk about here on Checking on the Arts, although we're going to do our best. Indie Memphis, it starts tomorrow, runs through Sunday. Morgan John Fox's movie, This Is What Love in Action Looks Like, is Friday night at 7 at Playhouse on the Square. Go online and reserve your ticket for that, because really time is running out. And I cannot stress more. Just go to the website, IndieMemphis.com, and you can get all the details there. Morgan John Fox and Eric Jambor, my guests today. Thanks so much for coming in, guys.
Thanks for having
us.
Appreciate it.
Good afternoon. I'm Khaki Walton. Checking on the Arts is made possible by contributing listeners, the Dixon Gallery and Gardens, and the Orpheum Theater.
1, 2, 3, 4!
It's 1986. Nobody goes to roller rinks anymore.
Hey, losers.
This is rock and roll. There are rules, man.
Great show, guys.
Yeah, but you guys have thought about joining a real band?
We don't even know you.
Smart guy. Smart guy. Smart guy.
She guys glad to be moving in with us?
Scary thought.
See, the fact is, we as a band have moved beyond you as a manager.
You're firing me? Why?
I'm Greg Glaberman.
I manage and promote bands.
Says here you sell furniture, Greg.
I booked you a show this weekend, a real show. It's at the bottom of a 4-band bill, but it's a good start.
That's all you get to hear right now of the fictional band The Fingers, because you need to go see the screening of Losers Take All. It's about that group, and it screens Saturday night. I've been thinking it's Friday all day long, but it screens Saturday night at Playhouse on the Square. It's part of the 14th annual Indie Memphis Film Festival. Other venues for the festival, which opens tonight and runs through Sunday, of course, Malco Studio on the Square, and also the Brooks Museum of Art. And I have a studio full of folks today. Andrew Pope and Wynn Koslick wrote the film and produced it. Mike Ryan's a producer as well, and Alex Steiermark is directing the film, which is a perfect fit for him, and we'll talk about that in just a second. First of all, it's nice to have you all here.
Thank you.
Let me just ask the two writers, first of all, is this a write what you know kind of thing?
I mean, Wynn and I are both big music fans, indie rock especially. We went to school together in Athens, Georgia, which has a pretty proud history of that genre. But it's kind of a love letter to that period of American music, sort of 1980 to 1990, roughly.
You got a lot of original music for this movie, did
right.
you?
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've got some gems from Alex Chilton and Dinosaur Jr. and other bands like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall Crenshaw, the executive music producer.
Right.
That was great.
How did you snag that?
Well, actually, one of our executive producers, Andy Meyer, it was through our music attorney, AJ Coriel.
There are such things.
Right, yeah. And he was friends with Marshall and introduced him to the project, and he loved the idea. And
he read the script on a flight to London and called the next day. He loved it. So,
It is about the Fingers.
Yeah.
The Fingers.
A fictional band. totally fictional, but maybe based on a hybrid of some different bands of the era. But, just four regular guys, kind of, ragtag bunch, looking to play some music.
So this is the whole love letter to bands who got in their car and took off and played little clubs and did those little mini tours and came back and played for the hometown crowd. And,
right,
and they
exactly.
were always out there just working hard every weekend.
Yep. Kind of like now.
Kind of like now.
Yeah. Which is why we think it's kind of very contemporary in that way.
Well, you've had a lot of experience with music. This is your third feature.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
You did a lot of work with Spike Lee, I know, and Ang Lee, too. That's pretty much, you worked on music.
That's true. I have a sort of a previous life as a music supervisor and music producer for movies. And in fact, the first feature that I directed, Pray for Rock and Roll, I got involved because originally we talked about me producing the film, and I said that what I really wanted to do was direct it, and so that was how I got to do that. But one of the things that struck me when I first read the script, because I was working with Mike Ryan on another project, and Mike said, these guys have this great script, you ought to read it. I was just struck with how truthful it was about music and how really smart it was. I mean, these guys did a great job getting their understanding and love of music into it, and the characters read like real musicians.
From the trailer, I just thought, I know every one of these guys. They were my friends back in 1992,
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to ask you, speaking of friends, when I got the press release from Indie Memphis, and I read the little blurb, and all the indie rock comedy set in Memphis circa 1986, and it says, an inept but well-meaning band manager furniture salesman, and I went, oh, my God, that was one of my best friends. No kidding. I mean, is this based on a real guy?
No, it's not.
Oh, my God.
Although we all know that guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he was really a band manager and furniture salesman on Summer Avenue.
Hilarious. Oh, really? Wow.
Jim Alderdice, if you're listening. I emailed my brother, and he went, oh, my God, they made a film about Dice Man. I can't believe it. But, yeah, corner table at the South End with a lamp on it like a Big Shot. You know?
Oh, right.
Oh,
yep,
yeah.
So
you've captured it. Oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe
well,
it.
Well, Adam Hirschman, who plays Greg, the manager, is one of my closest friends.
Oh,
so it was a great opportunity to work with him. We've been looking for something to do, you'll see. He's the guy.
he ran with it. He very much made it his own. And he's fantastic.
Well, what about the guys playing the band members? I mean, were they musicians, or how did you go about casting them?
Mm. Well, we spent a lot of time casting. I mean, for me as a director, that's one of the most important parts. I kind of feel like if you have a great script and a great cast, that makes the directing part of it a lot easier. And we really spent a lot of time on it. I have two casting directors that I work with, Amanda Harding and Amanda Koblin, and they are one's in New York and one's in L.A. We saw a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I would talk with them and try to get a sense of how musical they were. The fact is that Kyle Gallner, who plays the lead singer, had really never done anything like that before, but I could tell that he had the right vibe. It was just going on instinct, sort of meeting with him. Billy Kay, who plays the guitar player, he is a guitarist, so he nailed that. And then Peter Brensinger, who plays the drummer, he's just a little mathematical genius who memorized every drum pattern and was brilliant at it, and that's always the hardest thing to pull off. And Aaron, who plays the bass player, played guitar, but he showed up playing the bass. And then when we rehearsed, we in the mornings we did scene rehearsals. In the afternoons we had like rock and roll boot camp. And by the time we were filming, these guys were a band. And we had great local coaches, John Paul Keith and Paul Bucagnani, were our coaches, and they were phenomenal.
Oh,
they got those guys ready.
Yeah, those guys, they even played a song at the kickoff party. and nailed it. I think we were all a little nervous, like, God, these guys won't screw it up. And they came and just knocked it out of the park. And everyone was stunned at how great it was.
You could see that on YouTube if you want.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah, because I did. I Googled Losers Take All and the Fingers, too, and then I found some YouTube clips, so people can see that. And people can also go to loserstakeall.com because there's a big website up now, and you can see trailers and just all kinds of things. Well, let's talk about location, because it's location, location, right. Location, and you have the best location you possibly could have had.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, we love Memphis, and I couldn't have imagined a better place to make the film. You know, the local crew is outstanding, but the locations are fantastic. I mean, it really is tailor-made for our story. I mean, you know, a lot of Memphis seems like it could be 1986, and so there wasn't a lot of window dressing that we had to do. And there are just some great venues, great bars and clubs and
studios.
The Original Antenna Club.
The Original Antenna Club. We filmed in, yeah. And everybody was just so supportive. And coming back here to this festival, you know, it feels a bit like coming home. But we covered some great – I mean, location scouting was one of the best parts of the film.
That was fun. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, no, we have to go bar hopping.
Yeah. Right.
We have to go see live music.
Yeah, we have to go to the Lamplighter.
Oh, God.
You
hung around my hood, which yeah. I really love. So the Lamplighter, the antenna, what else stood out? What else can we see?
Ernestine and Hazel's.
Of course.
Best
jukebox in town.
Where do we shoot?
We liked High Records, but we didn't shoot there.
Yeah, we didn't go to
Royale Studios.
I forget the name of the studio.
We shot at Arden Studios. Yeah, that was a little dream come true. That was
Arden,
which doubled as a rehab center.
Yeah, we shot two scenes there. One was a nice recording studio that the Fingers play in, and then another scene is Greg, the manager, in drug rehab.
Oh, so. No.
In a robe.
Yeah. In a robe. Well, listen, our time is running out, and I'm so sad because I could talk about this for a long time. I've been looking forward to this interview a lot. The Indie Memphis Film Festival, it's their 14th annual festival, opening tonight and running through Sunday, and they are screening films because it's gotten so big, which is great. They're doing it always at Malco Studio on the Square and also at the Brooks Museum of Art and Playhouse on the Square. Losers Take All, the gala screening will be screened this Saturday at 7 o'clock, and that's going to be preceded by Two-Legged Rat Bastards. I got to say that on the radio, which is always
fun.
Are
you allowed to say that?
Oh, I just did, so I hope so. Well, Andrew Pope and Wynn Koslick are the writers and producers. Mike Ryan, the producer who's been speaking from afar, and Alex Steiermark directed the film. And I'll see you guys tomorrow night, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning, I'm Kaki Walton. Checking on the Arts is made possible by contributing listeners and the Memphis Symphony Orchestra. The 14th annual Indie Memphis Film Festival kicked off last night, and they have a terrific lineup of films that will be screened at three different venues through Sunday. Malco Studio on the Square, of course, Brooks Museum of Art, and Playhouse on the Square. And coming up this Sunday at 5 o'clock at Playhouse on the Square, they'll be screening the HBO documentary film Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, which is a film by Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky that focuses on the murder of three eight-year-old boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. And this became an 18-year project for these two filmmakers. And Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory is the final chapter in this story that they have been working on for such a long time, and a story that eventually had a very positive ending. Jonathan Silberberg is a film and television producer living in New York City. He worked intensively on the third chapter, Paradise Lost Purgatory, and he'll be in town to do a question and answer following the screening on Sunday. And he joins me this morning to talk about the making of these three films. Good morning. Thanks for being with us. Well, I'm right across the Mississippi River in Memphis, Tennessee, and people in this area were a little taken aback that anybody in New York or Hollywood would care what had happened in a little town like West Memphis. I mean, horrible things happen in towns every day all over the country, and I just wondered how West Memphis, this little town in the Mississippi Delta area, ended up on the filmmakers' radar.
Well, I think first and foremost, there was a tragedy that was of national proportions that happened on May 6, 1993, when three little boys, 8-year-olds, were found murdered behind the Blue Beacon truck wash in West Memphis, Arkansas. And that story made it into deep in the New York Times. There was a small article that the head of HBO documentary film, Sheila Nevins, sent to Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky and said, now this is quite a story. This sounds like something that should be investigated. And those two filmmakers decided to go down and figure out what was happening. And originally, they thought that they were going to go down and investigate a case about some guilty teenagers who were doing horrible things about Jesse, Jason, and Damien. And when they got down there and they began looking more closely at the case, they began to think that there was something more complicated going on.
What did the filmmakers experience when they landed in West Memphis? I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, the level of culture shock had to be pretty intense.
I think for them it was like going to Mars. It was a totally different place. And yet, you know, they were parents themselves, and they were first and foremost trying to interact with the families of these young boys who had been taken from the families. And so that was a real commonality that they could look to. But they definitely sensed that something was going on that was wrong, and what concerned them more than anything is that the justice system didn't seem to be functioning as it should. So,
well, how do filmmakers go about gaining such incredible inside access to everybody involved? I mean, I can kind of understand the defendants. They want the publicity and the victims' families, but it just seemed like the access to the law enforcement people, the judges, the prosecutors, the detectives, that had to be tough.
I think that it's important to remember when this happened, which was 1993, and it was really right before both the boom of the internet and what we all think of as, you know, reality TV now. And I don't think people had a fear or an understanding of cameras in the same way. And that was probably a healthy thing, because these guys' motivation was really to get in there and try to cover this story from all sides and to be a sympathetic ear to both the local law enforcement and to the judge and to the prosecution and also the families of the murder victims and the families of the accused. And they were really trying to walk that line and be witnesses to what was going on rather than taking a strong aside from the beginning before they understood what was really happening.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I thought, you know, as documentary filmmakers, I don't know, do you sometimes go in there with a set agenda, or do you go in there, roll the camera, see what happens, and then make sense of it from there?
Well, I think Joe and Bruce and myself, we all come from a cinema verite background, meaning we really think there's a value to turning on the cameras and being a witness of things and then letting the audience have that same experience and come to their own conclusions about what's happened. That's more engaging than lecturing to an audience about what they should think. We really like to show them different perspectives and let them come to their own conclusions. That said, in the Paradise Lost series, I think it's interesting to look at the three films, and the approach changed in some ways. During Paradise Lost 1, Joe and Bruce really didn't know what to think, and they weren't sure what was going on in that situation. And so I think that they were discovering themselves and observing themselves. But by the time the second film had rolled around, and in fact, long before the first film was finished, they really had a good sense of what they felt. They thought that there had been a miscarriage of justice that happened here, and they wanted to show that, and they wanted to help resolve it. So I think when you see the first film, really it doesn't have a perspective or as strong a perspective. Though it's there, it kind of lies further underneath the surface. But by the time you get to the third film, there's certainly a perspective in place that there's been a miscarriage of justice. It's really wrong.
Well, it had to be surreal, especially in the second film, because you're looking at monumental lapses of logic and just disregard for any other suspects, any other evidence, any other forensic evidence by West Memphis law enforcement, and it's jaw-dropping. And I thought that I thought that Damien Eccles said something really interesting in the second film. He said, you know, they may think we're innocent, but they certainly can't admit it now. I mean, it's going to make them, it's just going to make them look like they failed and they were wrong, and who wants to admit they're wrong?
You do get the sad sense that after a certain point, this became political, that maybe at the beginning that there was a sincere interest in prosecuting folks, although maybe, an incompetent role on the part of law enforcement and maybe the prosecutors. But by the time everything plays out, you definitely feel like it's political and that these guys don't really quite want to admit what's happened. Because the resolution of this case, where these guys get out on this bizarre Alford plea, right, where they essentially get to proclaim their innocence and are released by the state, but plead guilty, the nonsensical nature of that plea sort of tells you everything, right? If the state believed they were guilty, they wouldn't let three murderers out of jail. But here they've come up with this sort of odd political compromise that's really hard to even understand.
Well, it is, and at the time it just, you know, it made you feel sick, and then you thought at the same time, well, I guess this is their way of, what, not having to expect a humongous lawsuit later or something?
I definitely think, and if the prosecutor gave that explanation himself, so the state is trying to save themselves from a lawsuit. The sad part is that the state seems to maybe also be trying to save themselves from having to continue the investigation. And that's the real tragedy that we definitely are focused on this resolution to the case. If you believe that these three guys are guilty, then you believe that the state let three murderers out of jail, and if, like most people, you believe that they're not guilty, then you believe that the state came to this strange compromise that basically allows them to avoid a lawsuit against the state, but also makes it so that they aren't looking for whoever actually committed these crimes, and that's a great tragedy. They're still three murdered 8-year-old boys from 1993 and presumably somebody who's guilty of that crime. And there's no motivation for the state to try to solve that crime at this point.
Well, all through the films, and I want to mention that Paradise Lost, the first movie, the child murders at Robin Hood Hills, is going to screen Friday, November the 4th. That's today at 2 o'clock at the Brooks Museum of Art. And then Paradise Lost 2, Revelations, is going to be screened Saturday, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock at Brooks Museum of Art. But people can see Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, Sunday night at 5 o'clock. And if they haven't seen the other two, they're still going to understand the arc of the story.
That's right. We went to great lengths to make it so that just by watching Paradise Lost 3, you can really understand everything that happened here, because we assume that there's a huge audience of people who aren't up to date on this story. So you can come right into Paradise Lost 3 and understand everything that's going on.
Weren't you all working on the third film when the news came down that there was some really important information coming out about the case?
Well, that's right. We had been finishing the film that was going to premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. We were doing the final sound for the film and the final color for the film with the idea that we would release the film on HBO leading up to the evidentiary hearings that were scheduled for early December, and hopefully bring attention and educate people about this and provide a little bit of a rallying point for all the many people who were going to be paying a lot of attention to this case. And what happened was, right as we were doing that, the news came down and we got a little jump on it that something major was going to happen. And we all jumped on planes with our cameras and got our crews together and went and filmed what turned out to be this amazing last-minute release of these guys. And then we went immediately to work finishing the film all over again and redoing the end to include this amazing new development.
Well, I guess it really doesn't get any better for a documentary filmmaker than to see an outcome like this.
That's right. I think the hope of so many documentaries is to affect the world. Initially, when the original films were made, Joe and Bruce would have told you they were really trying to be great storytellers and that they weren't out there trying to affect the world. They wanted people to be a witness to the world. But as they saw the injustice that was happening unfold before their eyes, they were really excited to try to help and try to have, as they always say, to try to help move this off the entertainment pages and into the editorial pages and affect change. And this was the greatest outcome that anybody could possibly ever hope for.
Well, we're looking forward to Purgatory, and we want to mention, too, that just as when the story was first told with the crime and the trial, and then we saw revelations and so many different things were presented with that film, this third film also takes a lot of twists and turns, and it's going to be a riveting story with some information that people might not know about or might not remember having heard about as this case went on, because we're talking about 18 years of an ongoing story.
That's right. Hopefully people can come and see it at Indie Memphis on Sunday, and if not, they can see it on HBO in January.
We'll look forward to it. So Paradise Lost, Purgatory, the gala screening this Sunday at 5 o'clock at Playhouse on the Square. And Jonathan, you'll be in town for that screening, I hope?
That's right, and we'll have a little Q&A afterwards, and look forward to being back down in Memphis.
Well, listen, thank you so much for talking to us, and we'll look forward to seeing you in town. And we want to remind everybody that the Indy Memphis Film Festival goes through Sunday at three different venues, Playhouse on the Square, Studio on the Square, and the Brooks Museum of Art. And they have a terrific lineup of feature films, documentary films, short films, local films, and you can see a complete listing of films, showtimes, and venues at their website, indymemphis.org. Don't forget about the Paradise Lost original film, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, screening today at 2 o'clock at the Brooks Museum. Paradise Lost 2 Revelation screening tomorrow at 11 a.m. at the Brooks. And so if you want to catch up on all of those films, not necessary, but do it, because they're both so riveting. And then you can see the third installment, Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory, this Sunday at 5 at Playhouse. And you can also find out all about the West Memphis 3 story at WM3.org. And I want to thank the producer, Jonathan Silberberg, for being my guest this morning. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.